You can walk the history of printing on the spines of Bibles. So ever since I started setting type, I wanted to do a Bible.
Coming up on In Contrast, illustrator, printer, and designer Barry Moser. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio. Barry Moser is the world-famous designer, illustrator, and printmaker of countless works of literature, including The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and The Divine Comedy. Best known among them are the illustrations of the Pennyroyal Caxton edition of the Bible, which he did over a period of 4 years. It is the first Bible fully illustrated by one individual since Gustave Doré's La Sainte Bible of 1865. Moser is also the Irwin and Pauline Alper Glass Professor of Art at Smith College. Barry Moser, thank you for coming to the show. Let me start with a general question. Are you a good reader?
Well, I'm a careful reader. I've had trouble reading when I was a kid. My self-diagnosis is that I had, dyslexia to a point, and I still think I have a degree of dyslexia. So reading was a real chore for me when I was a kid, and I didn't read. I have said this a number of times, and I'm not exaggerating. I got through elementary school, 6 years of a military school, and 4 years of college without really reading a book. The Classics Illustrated comic books got me through all of my literature examinations. But then I learned how to set type after moving up here from Tennessee, and someone said one time, setting type by hand is the most intense form of reading there is. It's upside down and backwards, which appealed to my dyslexia. And then I began to read, and I mean really read, voraciously. So today, I generally read maybe 50 books a year.
Do you see the works of literature when reading them immediately in images?
Yes. I'm reading a book, say a Cormac McCarthy novel. As I read, I'm seeing it as surely as I were seeing it on a film. It's like a movie unfolding in front of me. Now, when I go back, if I happen to be illustrating that book, that first impression will linger for a while, but I'm not beholden to it. Because if I go back and I start studying and joining this to that and making these connections and relationships, that first idea may very well go away.
When you were a child, already think of yourself as an illustrator, or did that come later?
Oh, much later, after college, after I moved north in 1967. No, when I was in college, somebody like Norman Rockwell was considered, no, you don't want to do that. And that's illustration. And was seriously looked down upon, as it still is in many quarters. So when I started setting type, that got me over to why can't I put images with that? And that's when I started illustrating books. And the first book I did was The Flowering Plants of Massachusetts, and I did it out for the University of Massachusetts Press, and I was working inside the herbarium there at the university. I did nearly 400 drawings of plants. And that was the first one. And then after that, I started engraving and making my own books. And
you have done close to, 250?
No, it's closer to 400 now.
Mm. Walk me through the process of illustrating a book. What sections of the book you choose to illustrate? How do you come to the visuals, to the images? How long does it take you to shape an image? Does it depend on the book that you have or what the publisher is offering you?
If it's a book for children and the text can fit on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, that's one way of approaching a book. I have not many words, and I've got a lot of pictures. And usually those pictures are going to bleed off the page, so I know what the format is going to be. But if you come to a book like the Bible, that has to be carefully planned out. That's 1,200 pages. And what I do, this surprises people. I bought a new translation of the Bible in 1994, I think it was, and mainly because they're really thick. So I had made a list of illustrations of possible images, a list of maybe 400 things. And I did that from images of my own reading of the Bible when I was a kid. I was a boy preacher for a while, so I read the King James Bible 3 or 4 times. And there were stories and images from my reading, my first readings, that were personal to me. Then I went back and I looked at my painters and graphic artists that I admire, like Rembrandt and Dürer and so forth, Velázquez, and see what they chose to do. So that's a second list. So I put that all together and I put a sticky on the foredge of this big, fat, new translation of the Bible. And I studied the stickies. Where there were none, I had to go in and put stickies in. Now, it's surprising that the place where there were no stickies was in the books of poetry, the book of Job, Proverbs, and so forth.
And why?
I don't know why. Apparently, not many people were drawn to the Song of Solomon.
Because they are hard to visualize?
I don't.
Because they are in poetic form?
Not at all. Not for me. The Song of Solomon is so short, you don't have much opportunity. I just have a man and a woman making love in a field. Real simple. And it's a full-page illustration. The Book of Job presented different problems. But what I do is I decide what I'm going to illustrate. I'm going to illustrate Jesus and the crown of thorns. I'm going to illustrate Adam and Eve. I'm going to illustrate Shifra. So if they're major images, I'm going to give them a full page. If they're not, then I'm going to assign a shape. And the shape is mutable at this point. I don't put it in there and say, okay, this is the way it is. I then take the shapes. Now, mind you, there are no illustrations yet. There's no image. It's just rectangular shapes. And I will take those shapes and I will stretch them. A page ends two lines short. I will stretch the image two lines so that the last line comes out where I want it to be. The images are really being manipulated by the text. Then once I have that all done, everything settled, then I start going in and deciding what the image is going to look like, what I'm going to include in there. Sometimes there's an illustration in the New Testament, for instance, of the ship that St. Paul's on. It's insignificant, really. But I needed to drive the text out one more page. So I chose to do that because of where I needed to drive it, so I put it in.
Once you have settled on the images and how you're going to manipulate or expand the text, how long does it take you, for instance, to make the image of Moses or the image of Jesus? Who are your models? In what way do you still have a conversation with past masters that you have looked at, Velázquez and others? Do you imitate what they do? Do you reject what they do?
No, I don't imitate. I steal. As simple as that. But even if I do steal something from Velázquez, it's going to be mine. It's like a bird taking over another nest. They will configure that nest to their own needs. I pull no punches about that.
In putting together the Bible, you are here dealing with the central text of the Western civilization, the one that has shaped the three major Abrahamic religions. This is very different than illustrating Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde or the short stories by Edgar Allan Poe or Alice in Wonderland. Do you feel more nervous as a result? Do you feel there might be readers that are unhappy with the representations that you make?
In terms of the Bible, I was a little concerned. In fact, I asked a friend of mine if I could buy a Kevlar vest when I went out on the road, especially traveling in the South, you know, where I come from. They take religion that pretty seriously. Then Ann Patchett said to me one day, she said, I was telling her about this, she said, Barry, don't be ridiculous. Nobody kills anybody over art. But you asked about models and you mentioned Moses. Moses is taken directly from a photograph that my daughter made on Martha's Vineyard. She's down on the beach. I'm standing at the top of the bluff. I took a bedspread off of the bed and wrapped it around me as if, you know, like a robe of some kind, and held up a stick, and she photographed from below. It was just set up, like setting up a scene or a shot in a movie. You ask about my models. I'm the model for that. I'm also the model for the head of Goliath the Gittite. There are three self-portraits in there, which is typical of the books that I do. Jesus, on the other hand, was a model that I found in Pinocchio's, a restaurant, an Italian restaurant in Amherst. His name is Louis Silver, and I'm watching him work, and he's got this marvelous face, and I assume he's Italian. He's cooking at an Italian restaurant. So I asked him, I said, hey, Lou, would you do me a favor? He had a big ponytail. I said, would you take the rubber band out of your ponytail and let me see what happens when your hair is around your face? He did, and I said, oh, if you will you be my Jesus? Will you be my model? And he agreed to do that. And he was absolutely marvelous. And at the end of the project, I said to him, I said, you know, Lou, you were really, really good. He brought his kids along too sometimes. And there's an image in there of Jesus sitting with his arm around a child. And this is him and his daughter. So at the end, I said, you know, you're really terrific. The only thing that would have made it better would be that you were a Jew. And he said, I am.
Did he end up offering you his own judgment of the final image? Did he like it?
He loved it. And then he opened up a restaurant in New York City before the project was finished. And then he died. He died in his early 40s. Mm-hmm. You know, a very sad thing. So,
are you religious?
Oh, that's a very good question. In some cases, I would say to somebody who asked me, that is none of your business. I am what I refer to as a deeply religious agnostic. There are two things in terms of religion that I have no use for. One is fundamentalism of any stripe. I don't care whether it's Christian fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism, Muslim fundamentalism, it doesn't matter. People who are of that stripe believe that they are right. They are, in fact, certain. And certainty is something I don't have any use for. And I have the same feelings about atheists and atheism. There is a degree of certainty there that I can't tolerate. So, no, I'm somewhere in between. I mean, I don't know how my cell phone works. Therefore, I'm agnostic about it. I just don't know.
You just don't know.
Yeah, just don't know.
Did you grow up as an agnostic, or did you come to be an agnostic as an adult?
I came to be agnostic after I became a preacher in the Methodist Church, and I was a fundamentalist. I was also an Arianist. I was also a racist and an anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, because that's the way I was brought up. But then when I came to religion in a serious way, rather than going with my grandmother on Sunday, but when I got saved at a revival meeting, then I became a licensed Methodist minister. And I was very religious at that point. I was also certain that everybody else was wrong except me. After that, I had a couple of experiences, one involving a girl who got pregnant who was in my youth group. The only place that girl and her boyfriend were welcome in the church was in my Sunday school class. Mm. That's where the small end of the wedge got planted. And I left that church and went to another church to preach. And my father was a manager at Chattanooga Golf and Country Club. I hung out in the kitchen with this chef, a guy by the name of John, big black man, about the size of a door. And John was the deacon in his church, Baptist church, and he asked me to go to church with him. I said, John, I can't go to church with you. Daddy'd kill me, kill you too. And this dialogue went on for a while, and then one day he says to me, well, you don't have to tell him. And I said, well, you're right. So I met John downtown, parked my car. He took me to his church. I'm the only white face within a quarter mile radius. And it was a marvelous service. I was so welcome in that church. Now, we're talking 1969 here. Go out to sit in the sanctuary with John and his preacher, who made John look like a very small person. I said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going with John. He said, no, you're not. He said, no man of God going to go sit out there with the sinners. You're going to come up here and sit with me. So I got up there, and he had me do the morning prayer and all this kind of stuff. And it was a wonderful morning. But my point is this, that if John had gone to my church, he likely would have been beaten or hung in a tree outside the front yard.
Barry, is it fair to say that the images that you have made for the Pennyroyal Caxton Bible are images that want to give a different view of religion? Do they react against a particular perception? Are your images there in order to draw people into the Bible in any way? Why did you do these images?
Well, let me answer that first question first. And do I want to draw people in? Yes. And the way I'm hoping to draw people in is that there are no halos in this thing. Every face that you see throughout those 1,200 pages is based on reality, somebody who really does exist. There's no holiness about any of this because those people were just like you and me. You know, you get up in the morning and you take a leak. Everybody does. And those people did too. Even Jesus, St. Thomas Aquinas said that Jesus was in every part a man. It had to be, otherwise he's not incarnate. So anyway, everybody has an aspect of being human. I want people to open that book up and see somebody and think that reminds me of Joe, worked down there at the service station, you know. That's what I want. Mm. In that sense, yes, I do want to draw people and feel like they are a part of this thing.
You have done so many extraordinary illustrations for so many different books, but this particular project, the Pennyroyal Caxton Bible, is one that you have become legendary for. Was this your idea? Did somebody come up with it and bring it to you?
No, it was my idea. Ever since I learned how to set type, mainly self-taught. I had a lot of good help from a man by the name of Harold McGrath, one of the legendary 20th century printers. But when I was learning to set type, I'm, of course, reading about typography. And someone said one time that you can walk the history of printing on the spines of Bibles. So ever since I started setting type, I wanted to do a Bible. So I'm down in New York City, mid-90s, 1994 or something like that. Earlier, actually, about 1990, and I had a show at the old Gotham bookstore up on the second floor, and it was an exhibit, a very small exhibit of some watercolors I had done for a story about Truman Capote. There was this guy there with his wife and a big man. He introduced himself, and he collects Pennyroyal Press books. His name's Bruce Kovner, and he said, "Is there a project you want to do that you haven't done?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to do a Bible." And he said, "Well, why haven't you done it?" And I said, "Well, I'm not old enough." I was 55, I think, at the time. I said, "I'm not old enough to do it. My pressman's about to retire, and I'll never have the kind of money that it would take to do the project the way I want to do the project." And he said very casually, "Well, if you ever change your mind, you know, I might be interested in working with you." When it came time to do it, 1994, and I've only got 6 years to the end of the millennium. Well, five, but psychologically, the end is 1999. Sitting there and I'm thinking, how can I do this? And we're trying to figure a way to finance it through maybe limited partnerships. But I've been down that road a few times. I didn't want to get involved in that. So the ideal thing would be to find one person who would do it. And then, oh, somebody reminded me, you know, you talked to Bruce Kovner. Why don't you ask him? So I get in touch with him. And he calls me back and, make a long story short, he said, "Well, yeah, I agree to be the bank, but I want to see designs and so forth." And I asked him at that point, I said, "You want to have any kind of say?" He said, "No, no." He said, "My joy is going to be sitting back and watching you do this." But he did also say, "We're going to have a budget. And we're going to stay within the budget. Doesn't mean that we can't change the budget," which we did a number of times. I was out in Porter, Indiana, talking with Catherine and Howard Clark, who owned Twin Rocker Paper Mill, talking to them over lunch one day. And Catherine said, "How many of these Bibles, how many are you going to print on handmade paper?" And I said, "Well, none, because it's not in that budget." So she said, "Harumph, what if I make enough paper to print three, one for you, one for Bruce, and one for us?" I said, "Well, let me ask Bruce." So I get on the phone, call him, and he says, "Oh, I think that's a wonderful idea, but I think we should do 50 on handmade paper." So immediately the budget increased by about $150,000. So Bruce is one of the, almost always listed as one of the 100 richest men in America, and he put $2 million into the project. 500 books, 400 books, plus extra deluxe copies. So it cost an awful lot of money. People don't like to talk about money and art, but the two things are inextricable. You can't do a thing like this on your own unless you're a paper maker, a type designer, a punch cutter, printer, you know, the whole thing.
You need a philanthropist.
It's a community art. It's a social art, just like architecture and theater and film.
Now, you said that at 55, you were not yet ready, that you were not old enough. And yet, it seems from the way you tell the story that almost right away you started doing it. Why wouldn't 55 be right enough? What's the right age to do a project? This is the white whale, so to speak, of an illustrator and designer and printmaker like you. Can a young man do a Bible? And would the perception of what shows up in the pages be very different?
I don't know the answer to that question, whether a young illustrator could approach this, a young designer. I think if the book is successful, it's successful because I was a practicing Christian. I believed every word of the King James Bible as if it were the holy word of God. That puts me in a very particular and special place. It gives me a perspective that a young Catholic girl coming to the project might not have, because she hasn't fought the demons that are inside all of that.
Barry, could a person who doesn't believe, you describe yourself as an agnostic, but how about someone who approaches the Bible as a collection of stories, regardless of the religious dimension? And there are plenty of people that do this. Would you not consider that artist, no matter how talented she is, to be able to produce something of caliber because of the absence of religious belief?
Absolutely. Because I'm not a believer in the traditional ways, it gives me another step up. And I think that somebody could come to this who is not religious. Somebody, it's like Leonard Bernstein writing a mass. He doesn't believe in the mass. You don't have to be religious to write religious music. You don't have to be religious to design a cathedral.
Which brings me to a point that has become very controversial as of late. Does an artist have the right to depict, in your view, a landscape or a scene or a story from which he or she doesn't emerge? There is a big debate. Can a white artist depict an African-American experience, or can a non-Jew depict the Jewish plight? Do you have a stand on this?
To me, it's poppycock. If it works that you can't do anything that looks Armenian, say, why doesn't it work for me to say, because I come from a Viennese heritage, that you can't do anything that's Viennese? I mean, come on. I mean, no, I think that I have the right to do anything that I want to do. When an artist is circumscribed, whether it's governmental or religious or anything else, this is tyranny. And that's where dictators began, is shutting up the poets and the artists and the academics, the intellectuals.
By the way, how many images does the Penny Royal Caxton Library AABA Bible have?
267, I believe.
267?
Yeah, that's the ones that I kept and the ones that are published. Mm-hmm. There are also about 30 or so that were rejected.
And did you do anything with them?
Yeah, I printed them. In the super deluxe edition of the Bible, which comes in 7 volumes, one of the volumes is a complete set of the prints printed on Japanese handmade paper. So when we did that, I also printed the rejects.
Out of the three religions that have shaped Western civilization, all coming from Abraham as the main patriarchal source, two of them have a prohibition against images: Judaism and Islam. And for a long time, even marginal attempt at depicting parts of the Bible was seen as idolatry and as an element that needed to be suppressed. Do these thoughts of traditions that do not like illustrations of religious scenes cross through your mind when you are producing this, or even as you're about to embark on a project of this magnitude?
I am concerned. When I assembled my team to work on this thing, I asked a scholar by the name of Shalom Goldman to be my Hebraicist, to let me know, to vet the illustrations and let me know if I've got something wrong or something that would be offensive. I was less sensitive from the Christian point of view because I was.
Are you telling me that you felt that at some point that you could offend others by the images that you were?
Well, I didn't. If I offend someone, I don't care. That's fine. But I don't want to intentionally offend someone. I'm not out to do that. I just wanted to make sure through Shalom that I could not have any of the characters in the Bible clean shaven, because it was proscribed to shave. I didn't know that. So little details like that fed into it, makes the work more tenable from a scholarly point of view. The book, by the way, was never carried by any Christian bookstores. The image that caused the Bible bookstore not to carry it was the image of the Nativity. Now, the Nativity is the circumcision. It's not the three wise men coming across the hills and all that. And it's on the 9th day, is that right?
On the 7th.
7th. So my image is of this infant, this newborn, who happened to be a newborn twin, a friend of mine, my daughter's friend. And I went over to the house and I photographed this little guy many, many times. And so there was, the image ends up of the infant Jesus with his hands out in a cruciform shape, which is announcing what's going to happen later on. And you see his little pudendum. And that is what offended a lot of fundamentalist Christians. They didn't like to see the holy pudendum.
And I gather from the way you're describing the story that there is an integrity to your art, and so be it that they were offended. You would not change anything.
No. Not once I have given it all the thought processes, after I have consulted with two Roman Catholic consultants, Protestant consultant, my Hebraicist and all that. I would run these things by them if I had any question. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make sure that I was on strong theological grounds.
Earlier in our conversation, Barry, you talked about illustrating for children and illustrating a book like the Holy Bible. Is there a difference in your approach or attitude when you illustrate for children than when you illustrate for adults?
No, not really. I don't get into certain subject matters within children's books. I've done some children's books that are very, very serious. Mm. And I've done children's books that are very lighthearted, like The Three Little Pigs. I used to say, and be happy to say, that I'm the only illustrator in the history of the field that's had the King James Bible and Three Little Pigs on his desk at the same time. I won't go towards sexuality in children's books. I would rather see a child laugh than cry. Mm. It's pretty much as simple as that. Mm-hmm. I often illustrate in books for children will put in jokes that children won't see, but that their parents, when they're reading them, might pick up on and get a good adult laugh out of it. Like, for instance, in my first children's book, it was one of the retelling of some of the Br'er Rabbit stories. And in one of them, there's where they all get together and meet, and it's kind of like a bar, Miss Meadows' place. And I depict Miss Meadows as a cat. And then upstairs, the picture of the front of Miss Meadows' place, which is taken from a Walker Evans photograph. Upstairs in the window, you see a brass bed. So it's just little things right. like that. The children right. are never going to pick up on it, but right. a parent might.
Because a children's book has really two audiences. It's the child that sees it, but also the adult.
That's right.
Yeah. What is a bad Barry Moser illustration? When do you see something that you're not comfortable with?
Happens all the time, and I hope it continues to happen. If I ever do anything that I'm completely satisfied with, that's a death knell. I mean, like in the Bible, there's some in there that I wish weren't. I wish I had could do them over again. In fact, there are two illustrations in there in the trade edition that are not in the Pinero Caxton book. They're in the same place, but different images because I didn't like what I'd done, but it was too late to change it. So when I had the opportunity to slip in a couple of corrections, I took that opportunity. But what makes my images bad is time. I see them a year later and say, oh, good God, did I actually let that go?
Is it time because of when you see them later, or is it time because you didn't have enough time to produce them in the way you wanted?
I always have enough time. Well, I say that that's actually not true. But most of the time, that's true. It's usually because I think I'm tired of this, and I just quit and go on to the next thing. And that's where time will play in, because if I come back to it, I might not have time to redo it, like as I was saying about the Bible. The thing that makes my illustrations bad is the actual technical things with the washers and a watercolor are gummy and muddy, and I let it pass. Or when I'm doing an engraving, maybe I should have stopped at the first martini and not the second, you know, and I see things that are not going the way I want them to. But that's something that my readership, I don't think, will ever see. They won't know. Now, you asked me a question earlier that I didn't answer. What makes a bad illustration just in general, and what makes a bad illustration is an image that's stuck into a book. It has nothing to do or doesn't explore, doesn't deepen the text or take the text in an unexpected direction. But just, there it is, like the children's book that I'm thinking of. I'm not going to tell who did it or what the title is, but there's an image of Adam and Eve. And they're young. Both of them are really good looking. And they're white. They're pretty, you know, and you don't see any genitalia. You don't see nipples on a breast. You don't see any of the naughty bits, which in my Adam and Eve, I do. My Adam and Eve is an old couple, and neither one of them has a navel, which when people hear that, they think, whoa, never thought about that before. But my Adam and Eve, you can't tell if they're black, white, green. I mean, they're way in the distance. There's a line in Ezekiel that talks about the voice of God is like that of many waters. So the main subject in the Adam and Eve picture is the river. It's a stream coming down through the garden, and then Lucifer's in there somewhere. And I knew exactly where he was. He's very hard to find. And now it's been so long, I can't find him anymore.
From the way you described the process of putting together this mammoth of an endeavor, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of research. It takes a lot of manpower. And it takes a lot of resources, financial ones particularly. So one is given to think that this is a dying artistic form, but I would imagine that in the 19th century, people were saying already it was a dying form, and it's always dying, but it doesn't die.
That's exactly right. I remember when I moved up here, you could find a printing press, a Vandercook SP15 printing press. All you had to do was get a truck and go get it. Newspapers and print shops were getting rid of them. They were a burden. Today, if you find one, they go for around $10,000. And they're hard to find because people are printing letterpress all over the country. some of the most beautiful work being done today, and a lot of illustration work. There are illustration courses and illustration departments at RISD, at Pratt, at Savannah College of Art and Design, at Art Center School. All the big art schools have departments of illustration or illustration studies. So no, it's not a dying form in the least. Now, what I do with wood engraving, which is one of the most difficult media that exists to master, I don't think it's going to die. But people, I don't mean this to celebrate myself or anything, but people don't have the patience to do that and the endurance to spend 4 or 5 years learning a craft. You know, it's the 10,000-hour thing. Now, with all of the technological advances and all of the technical digital tools illustrators have, that's going to change. What I do is going to be antique in another 100 years. These new things will take over, and I have no problem with that. I mean, that's just evolution.
You talked about wood engraving, and most of the Barry Moser work that I know is in a black and white. Do you like color? You prefer to...
Well, I was trained as a painter, and I studied with a man, George Kress, who was one of the most amazing colorists I've ever known. I love color, and I know how to handle colors, and I do use color in my watercolor illustrations for books. But with wood engraving, no. The engravings, to me, are black and white. For Frankenstein, I did 6 portraits of the demon, of the monster, and those are colored, and I reserved color for the monster. There's no color anywhere else except typographic color. And I reserved the color for the monster because my sympathies were with him, not with that stupid Victor. But no, I don't often use color, and I didn't use any color in the Bible except typographic.
If all of our lives are narratives and we don't do anything but live in order for those stories to unfold, mm-hmm. What one or two moments in your life should be illustrated?
In my own life?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question, Elon. 1957, summertime. My mother and father had some guests over playing cards. The front door is open. The windows were open. There's an old fan sitting on the floor grumbling along, blowing the cigarette and pipe smoke out of the house. The front screen door was closed. And then up the road comes a clavalcade, which is the Ku Klux Klan's term for a cavalcade. They love alliteration. And so everybody went out on the porch to watch this go by. And when it had passed along, I can't tell you on the air what they were shouting out of the loudspeakers, but it was basically, never forget your place. And because there were black folks in that neighborhood. In fact, across the street from me and up the hill, which is very strange demographically, 3 black families. And the woman that lived in the house at the top of the hill had grown up with my mother right across the street from each other. They were lifelong friends. Her name was Vanita. After the clavalcade had passed by, everybody settled back down in their cars, and there was this god-awful wailing, and the screen door, which was latched, was slamming and slamming, and it was Vanita. And when she came into the house, she never came through the front door of the house, unless there was nobody around, came through that front door, and my mother took her in her arms. And I'm standing there, 17 years old, and I see a woman whose skin is raven-colored. I see that skin turn to the color of ashes in a fireplace. Now that I would illustrate. Mm. It would be extremely difficult. I don't know if I could do it in black and white, strangely enough, but that's one incident that changed my life. It was an epiphany for me. I had published a memoir 2 years ago called We Were Brothers, in which I tell that story and a lot of other stories. So there are so many, and I illustrated that book. But I illustrated it using old family photographs, and it's not, the illustrations are not narrative.
Let me conclude with one question. Can you describe for us your hands?
My hands?
Yes.
My left hand is withered, the very rarest thing called the... I have developed Parsonage-Turner syndrome, in which the ulnar nerve in my left hand, my left arm, was interrupted, and it's atrophied a great deal. It doesn't have much strength in it. And it's very different from my right hand. And I would say about my right hand is it's wrinkled and gnarly and stubby. I don't have long, graceful fingers at all. but it's strong. It's strong from 50 years of engraving, which is isometric. The left hand is holding the block still, the right hand is moving through it. And so I have strong hands, but they're kind of wrinkly. Come October, I'll be 3 years away from being 80.
It has been an enormous pleasure to have you. Your art is extraordinary. It has been a source of inspiration to me and to many others. And to hear you describe it in the struggles that you have to make it become visible on the page has been a lesson. Thank you, Barry.
Well, you're very generous. Thank you.
A work of literature exists not the moment an author writes it, but the moment a reader reads it. Each of us sees the adventures of Huckleberry Finn in a different way because each of us has a different imagination. Great illustrators of literary classics are therefore famous because they show us an aspect of a book in a way that all of us can see. Think of the famous illustrations of Alice in Wonderland. The 7-year-old Alice we see is a Victorian image with her nice long hair, her black shoes, and her beautiful dress on top of which she wears an apron. Over the centuries, we have had other Alices, but the image of her in Lewis Carroll's original 1865 edition reigns forever. A common misconception is that an illustrator of a literary classic is a great reader. Or even more curious, that that illustrator is a reader at all. It is a known fact that illustrators have not always read in their entirety the books they illustrate, and that the illustrations they have given us are the product of happenstance. A certain face, universally recognized as the face of a protagonist, happened to be the illustrator's next-door neighbor. To be a good illustrator of literature, you need to let your imagination free. You also need to trust chance. You need to be courageous. And you need to improvise. But of course, what you need the most is talent. Nobody really knows how a book becomes a classic. For one thing, no book is born a classic, even if marketers often want you to believe that. A classic is a book that people return to generation after generation because there is something in it that speaks to us all. What exactly that is a mystery. A classic is also a book that is lucky to have savvy and enduring readers. Those readers don't always like it. They don't always know how to read it. What they do know is how to imagine it. Next time on In Contrast, one immigrant story.
I know that this country is going through some very tough times. We don't know if DACA will remain. So it's always that fear.
Next time on In Contrast. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio.